Hello, I'm Michael Goodhart, Director of the Global Studies Center at the University of Pittsburgh. On October 30th, 2020, I got together for a conversation with Ruth Mostern, Director of Pitt's World History Center, and Nicole Heller, Curator of the Anthropocene at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh. Both Ruth and Nicole have been involved in an ongoing inquiry into the Anthropocene as an epoch of loss, organized by our two centers. As background, we initiated these conversations several years ago because we felt that discussions about the catastrophic and rapid changes now underway in the Earth system, transformations that include the mass extinction of species, the inundation of cities, and the collapse of entire ecosystems, focus largely upon concepts like sustainability, mitigation, and resilience. After all, the continued existence of human life on Earth may, in fact, depend upon efforts to geoengineer the atmosphere or the reefs, and it's understandable that we want to protect the remaining members of beloved non-human species. Yet scientifically oriented discussions about the urgency of averting or mitigating climate transformation have proven politically ineffective, with environmental concerns remaining secondary or tertiary despite the heroic efforts of committed activists. Meanwhile, the irrevocable loss has already begun, and it will accelerate even under the most optimistic scenarios for human ingenuity and investment. The nation of Vanuatu is disappearing from the map. Millennia of odes to the Yangtze River dolphin refer to a species that will never again be seen on Earth. The streets of Miami already flood on sunny days at high tide as a result of rising sea levels. Such facts suggest that we need something more than good planning and more than fresh approaches to familiar questions. We need new modalities of thinking about loss and commemoration that integrate traditional scholarly research with artistic and activist practices in ways appropriate for this epoch. When we began these conversations, these issues were largely uncharted, although a tremendous amount of really insightful work has poured forth in the past couple of years. But the questions are existential and profound, and adequate answers remain elusive. What are the limits of hopefulness? How can excellent and constructive science and policymaking coexist with the acceptance that there will be profound loss? Is it morally appropriate to pause for elegy when there's so much to be done? Is it morally defensible not to do so? What can we learn from historical cases of civilizational collapse? How might reflection on loss prove politically productive where consideration of science has fallen short? Does speculative fiction help us to envision what may be coming? How can we take stock of what exactly it is that we are losing? The conversation that you're about to hear was prompted by our joint realization that we were thinking about loss differently under the combined weight of the tumults of 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic, the outpouring of rage following the brutal murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Tony McDade, and many others, and the systemic racism that they again laid bare. A year of record fires, storms, and climatic upheaval, and of course, the presidential election. I kicked off the conversation by asking Ruth and Nicole to talk about how their thinking about loss had changed this year.
You know, I think when I started thinking about the idea of loss and the Anthropocene, and I was very influenced maybe 5 years ago or so now by reading Learning to Die in the Anthropocene and looking at the Anthropocene photographs of Edward Bertinsky. And both of those things, I think, got me started. Those were the things that got me thinking about climate upheaval and the climate crisis as being something that we could approach through the framework of loss. That is, thinking about loss as a sort of a critical intervention relative to a kind of a techno-utopianism, a sort of, we'll just solve this and kind of keep going. But what I've been thinking, kind of starting even before the cataclysms of 2020, but really accelerated in my own thinking in the last few months, is the idea that that way of thinking about loss is a sort of an armchair approach, right? Kind of looking at climate change, potential social collapse, dislocation from some point of remove from it. And increasingly, that feels unsatisfactory to me. that although it that commemorative stance, that curatorial stance is still important, it is increasingly seeming really inadequate to me as loss feels less like something that's happening to other people and in the future, and something that, on the one hand, we're all experiencing together, but on the other hand, we're experiencing as an event of profound social inequality. And so yeah, I'm thinking of loss very differently than I was. I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, similarly, I would say that there's a sort of, a long 2020 has been in a way a kind of, it's really brought things to the foreground, issues that maybe kind of along the same lines were a little bit academic, concerns about unequal vulnerability to anthropogenic changes, kind of unequal cause of those anthropogenic changes. And these were sort of, they're intellectual issues, they're really concerning, they're really important. But this year really showed how deeply central those issues are and how precarious things are right now. We don't often, with climate change and these issues, there's a tendency to put them into the future, right? That the real loss is going to be later in the century. And the real vulnerabilities, but this year it's like it's game time, right? I mean, we don't have to think about the future because it's happening right now. And the precarity that I feel, the sort of overwhelming sense of kind of a loss, not only of kind of concerns about ecology and ecological systems or sustainability. Or socio-ecological system and how vulnerable they are, but including now our democracy, right? And the way that I've taken for granted that we would sort of have, at certain point, we would sort of be able to look together as a society at established facts, scientific facts, and kind of debate what do we do? Whether that's the scientific facts around the coronavirus or around climate change. And these days, it's just this sense of loss of our ability as a culture to even really talk about these things in the complexity that is required. And that's a really scary feeling.
One of the things, I mean, when I started thinking about loss as and a politics and ethics and aesthetics around loss as being an effective stance for thinking about life in the Anthropocene, part of the reason was because I couldn't envision a kind of political and intervention that, or an aesthetic intervention that would possibly be able to scale up to the scale of planetary change, right? The hyper object, as some people call it, of planetary change. And so that's what first got me thinking about the idea of, okay, well, one of the things that means is that we have to be able to make a sort of a politics and a virtue of some stepping back. But I think now, and absolutely part of the politic, part of this year and the politics of this year are what has made me think that in a new way about this, is that I still believe that there isn't actually a politics of environmentalism per se that quite makes sense in the present moment, but that it's absolutely a moment that calls for a vigorous, creative, passionate, new kind of politics, but not necessarily centered on environmentalism, right? Centered on justice, equality, anti-capitalism, new modes of social solidarity. And inevitably, and of course, one of the things that is a source of vulnerability and that people have to be organizing around is the environment. But I think not centering that as the object of political movement is what is making sense to me. Center the politics around social justice and environmentalism, or the social impacts of planetary cataclysm inevitably comes along for the ride. I think that's one of the things that we're learning with the coronavirus, for instance.
So part of what I find really interesting about what you just said, Ruth, is, you know, in a way that was not suggested or apparent by his campaign in the Democratic primary, Joe Biden has kind of embraced climate change and climate politics as a part of his campaign against Trump here, just in the waning weeks of the campaign, right? And I find that unexpected and interesting given the context, given a context in which science seems to be on the ballot, given a context in which racial and other inequalities in our society are to the fore. And, you know, in a way that I think he's probably not, and many of his people are probably not thinking through in the way that we might, it is interesting that, you know, this is the first time in my lifetime that climate has really emerged centrally in a major political campaign of any kind. So I don't know what to do with that, except to say that it's an interesting, I don't disagree with anything you said. And yet also, I think what's powerful about that is that also we see that kind of politics focused on injustice and inequality and trying to address those issues in our society links to the reassertion of the, it's hard to believe one has to say this, the reassertion of the importance of science and of climate in our social and political discourse.
Yeah, I mean, that's a, I think, really important point about what is going on right now and animating politics and the way that the climate justice movement has really, really been emerging and changing the discourse. So that even that term climate justice, right? So there's an intersectional movement that's been growing for the last decade or so that is really fusing, you know, concerns around women's rights, justice, social justice, racial justice. That kind of intersection has long been advocated in political science, actually, that I've seen, and journalistic studies, as sort of what needed to happen to bring the environment and climate issues, to make them a significant issue public, right? To bring them in, to kind of create a movement that was big enough to really have an impact on politics. So I think climate really has emerged as that unifying lens. I think that it's very true that climate has become really a central concept for the anxieties and precarities in the system at large, because it's so central to all of these concerns. And, you know, you even have surprising work sort of suggesting that women empowerment is a great way to fight climate change, one of the biggest ways to reduce emissions, you know, work by groups like Project Drawdown. So these kind of unexpected linkages. But I guess I would say, you know, for me, it's really not about an either or, you know, is it environment as the political movement or is it social justice? To me, it's really this intersection, right? And how can we hold these issues together as we seek solutions, right? Or seek to frame problems and struggle for ways forward. How do we kind of hold the needs of non-humans and the needs of humans? How do we hold all those issues together? That to me is a really exciting academic problem and more so a political and societal problem that feels, and so this is hopeful. I feel that that movement is emerging now and especially triggered in 2020.
Right. And I think those of us thinking a lot about climate really have a lot to learn. And increasingly, I've been trying to learn from the movements for Black Lives and Indigenous Lives, where it's for, you know, those are communities and movements for which it's never been a question whether it's a mourn loss or fight for a future. it's always been yes and. It's had to be yes and, right? It's an existential necessity for Black and Indigenous people, African descended and Indigenous people around the world, that they have to fight for survival, but also that they have to do it in the context of profound and existential and civilizational scale loss. They haven't had the luxury of separating those two things into different kinds of movements or different ways of being politically. And I'm hopeful that that's the future of how we also think about climate.
The other piece of it for me has been, I'm teaching Introduction to Global Studies this semester, and I'm using the Raj Patel and Jason Moore book, History of the World and Seven Cheap Things. And their focus on capital is seen throughout the book as a kind of matrix of connection to make sense of the modern world has been fascinating and helpful to be thinking through as all these things are unfolding. And it reminds me, Ruth, of that piece you sent me the other day, which I just had a chance to read about, you know, the term Anthropocene itself and how useful is it and do we want to keep using it and what are the kind of politics involved in that?
Yeah, no, I'm actually, one of the things I need to do today is record my lecture for class on the Cheap Nature chapter of the Seven Cheap Things book. I'm teaching that in my world history class this week. And just as I'm rethinking, well, I'm rethinking loss, I think, in the same ways that you're talking about, Michael, that loss has seemed to me up until this last set of months as something that I keep at an intellectual remove. It's something that might happen in the future, or it's something that has happened to other people, but it's not something that I have participated in, or maybe it's something sort of aestheticized, like the poor monarch butterflies, they're so beautiful, I will not see them anymore. And now it feels like the loss of being able to see my family, my aging mother, to gather with friends, right? It's that kind of visceral and personal thing that it had never been before. So I'm rethinking what loss means, and I'm also definitely rethinking the utility of the term Anthropocene. I mean, in the way that it centers humans, and also in the way that it centers humans collectively as opposed to humans in their varying levels of privilege and precarity. And of course, the cheapness of nature. And I mean, I'm thinking about the Seven Cheap Things book right now, since I'm teaching a piece of it also. And then I'm also thinking about the book, A Billion Black Anthropocenes or None. What's the author's name? I want to say Karen Youssef? Catherine Youssef. And, you know, what she points out is that the origins, right, that nature-culture divide that is what cheap nature is about is both it's the origins of capitalism, it's the origins of the extractive relations to the earth that are what modern geology is about, right, mining, and it's the origins of slavery and imperialism. And all of those things happen simultaneously. They are all knotted together into one thing that is the same thing. And so when we use a term with a geological valence like Anthropocene, we are evoking one piece, but separating it out from the rest of this collective of Black and Indigenous displacement, violence to enslaved and expropriated people, and the history of mining.
Yes, A Billion Black Anthropocenes, incredibly powerful narrative. I mean, these are really important questions you're asking. And I think one of the things that really stuck with me from reading that particular book, as well as other critiques of the Anthropocene and the kind of politics that are implicit in it, in this lumping of humans into one sort of universal actor. What stuck with me a lot from that was this idea, you know, or this recognition, right, that whose world is ending, right? When we talk about the world ending right now, whose world are we talking about? And that for many people on this planet, the world has ended multiple times over. And she does kind of a brilliant job of asking the reader, asking anyone to sit with that recognition of what did it mean, you know, to be indigenous or to be a community that was enslaved, and the way that ended the world, right? And so that there's sort of the privilege that goes along with the naming of the Anthropocene, right? And the naming of the kind of the world ending, but from one point of view. That's been, for me, a huge kind of reckoning that I've had to do as a scientist in confronting these issues. And I'll say, you know, building off, Michael, what you were saying about a kind of loss of privilege or innocence.
What Nicole's referring to here is a long-winded and rather embarrassing comment that I had made earlier in the conversation about my twin realizations that 2020 had felt to me like a loss of innocence, and that experience had triggered a heightened awareness of my own privilege, privilege that both enables innocence and requires innocence for its maintenance.
I mean, that's part of what's going on in science right now, at least for myself and among some of my colleagues, is we're starting to really reckon with the history of ecology, of geology, of these disciplines, and the assumptions, what we've kind of taken for granted. We've always, I think ecologists have always seen ourselves as the good guys. And we are, in a lot of ways. The community has done incredible work to surface the environmental issues, to really focus on the lives of non-humans and protecting those lives, advocating for those lives. But there's also been an incredible way in which ecology has been a project deeply part of imperialism, capitalism, colonial settler, and natural history as well. And so for me, I'm reckoning with my work as a scientist and really reckoning with the field. So there's a loss that's happening there, but also this great sense of, okay, how do we liberate our field moving forward? How do we sort of become, what does a liberated ecology or natural history look like? And what role can the Anthropocene play in developing that theory or that new forms of science or knowledge making? Whether it's the Anthropocene or the Capitalocene, kind of trying to hold that concept, use it in the best way possible, kind of to forward these this agenda or this liberated kind of science.
One of the things I love about Patel and Moore is their use of this term world ecology, which I wish they would develop a bit more than they do, but it's a really helpful term because it focuses our attention to the connections between things that we might be habituated to separate. And one of the ways in which that really came home for me, just last night, there was an online screening of the film Push. Push is about the human right to housing, and it features former UN Special Rapporteur for Housing, Leilani Farha, and it talks about some of her investigations into the affordable housing crisis that's affecting the entire planet, really. Three things about that are interesting. First, in that it affects the entire planet, it is a kind of world ecological crisis, right? People don't have a place to live, and that's connected with how we live in the world and how we live in and through nature. Secondly, that crisis, like all social crises, reflects the social and economic and racial and gender and other inequalities that structure our society, right? So the housing crisis does not affect everybody equally or in the same way. And then the third piece that ties this together, in the film, Saskia Sassen is being interviewed, and she refers to the financialization of housing. In other words, the use of buildings not as homes, but as investments by private equity firms, investment banks, et cetera. She refers to it as making the housing market more like mining because it's a form of extraction. You appropriate a resource, You use it to extract the value that you can extract from it, and then you toss it aside. So one of the striking examples here was the way in which some of these private equity firms, Blackstone and some of its subsidiaries in particular, buy up public housing in countries all over the world, raise the rents, allow it to deteriorate even further than it already has, and then eventually walk away from those projects without spending any effort to invest or maintain the asset or anything, because it's like strip mining, right? They really just want to extract the value that they can extract. And the same way in which that crisis of strip mining and housing affects many minoritized populations, actual mining does the same thing, right? As we know from the experience of indigenous communities in the New World, as you know, just one of many examples that are ongoing today. So I think what's been powerful for me and really driven home in a lot of ways by the events of the last 8 months, and again, paying attention to the work of people like Mike Davis and Rob Wallace, thinking about the ways in which capitalism is central to creating the conditions in which pandemics like the one we're experiencing can emerge and flourish, is really seeing the environment and ecology not as separate political issues or ones that one has to be prioritized over the others, but really seeing the ways in which ecology just infuses everything that's going on and is central to the way we need to be thinking about all of these different developments.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that I really like about the Morin Patel book is, I absolutely agree with you about the term world ecology, and also the idea of cheapness as a key word, right? And what it means to, right? I mean, it's inherent in the history and function of capitalism to keep things cheap and to make everything into a commodity and to make everything into a commodity from which the maximum amount of profit can be extracted, whether it's the product of nature or whether it's human lives and human labor. And the experience, and I guess that's the argument for calling this a capitalocene rather than an anthropocene, is that it focuses not just on capitalism being the problem, but on the idea of the commodification of everything and the sort of making everything cheap, trying to find things for cheap, the product of nature and human lives, as being the root of the interconnected crises that we're experiencing. And one of the things that's been very much on my mind through the course of this pandemic is, you know, the fact that the rate of at which new zoonotic diseases, new diseases that are moving from animal to human populations, has been accelerating dramatically in recent decades. And that's because of this exploitation of the human wildland margin, right? The exploitation of cheap nature and the exploitation of people who live at that periphery of densely settled human society. So I absolutely agree with what you're saying about that, Michael.
Yeah, it's such, this notion of cheapness is such a fallacy, right? I mean, the capitalist system is completely, all of the real costs are being externalized. And that's really what the suffering is. The real costs of our market economy are being externalized in our changing climate. They're being externalized in the labor practices that are exploiting people and keeping them in poverty. And they're showing up in, you know, increased disease and this wildland urban interface, right? And the mining practices and this kind of leaving things devastated. And I guess for me, that's been the frustrating thing all these years in looking at environmental policy and politics, is when we've understood the real costs, right, of creating these commodities, but we kind of refuse as a society to really embed those costs into our markets. And I guess what I wonder is, why does this notion of cheapness persist? You know, why don't we organize politically to put the value back in, you know, to the real, to get the real price tag on things. And I know that there's a kind of ecological movement called ecosystem services that tries to put the real value back, but it's somehow still so embedded in a neoliberal capitalist marketplace that I don't think that's going to be effective. So what is like, yeah, what is the political movement or the ways in which we kind of move against this cheapness? Where does that start?
I think that's such an important question, Nicole, and Ruth, I'll let you say something in a minute, but I just wanted to interject that I think partly this loops back to what we were discussing earlier. What we're seeing is that the politics that works for that is not a politics of, you know, ecosystem services or, you know, I've read a bit of that stuff too, and I find it kind of creepy and neoliberal in the way that you were describing. But it's a politics that centers injustice and inequality, right? Because that's where the devaluation is manifest. And then that permeates into all of these other areas, including, crucially, the environment.
Yeah, the other literature that I've just started reading around the edges of, and I'm really interested in and would like to get into more deeply, is the degrowth movement, right? And one of the things, I mean, in addition to cheapness and in addition to profit, one of the other social organizations or aesthetics almost at the center of capitalism is the idea of consumption and the idea of growth. And that and of course, the more growth, the better in capitalism. And
well, we should also add in traditional understandings of socialism as well, right?
That's true. Good. Right. Yes. The more growth, the better in absolutely in both capitalism and socialism. Traditionally, growth is a measure of progress and progress is good. And the more consumption, the more growth it's possible to measure in both communist and capitalist economics, right? And in all of these, I mean, I'm starting to feel like one of the anchors for any kind of movement has to be around injustice and inequality, and another anchor has to be around challenging that core modernist idea, you know, that idea that grew up in the 16th and 17th century, along with capitalism, that the more growth, the better, and the more consumption, the better, because there is no way that we're going to be able to walk away from the cheapening of nature and labor and human lives if consumption and growth are core values.
Right, right. I mean, or we have to redirect it, like consumption and growth, like consumption of, I don't know, relationships, right? Positive relationships and growth of positive relationships. What if we could measure our economic activity in something radically different, right? Rather than just in, you know, how many widgets were there made, but instead how many people were united together in webs of reciprocity and sharing of food and sharing of love and music. You know, you can imagine a radically different way to think about what growth and consumption could look like.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that's really interesting about what you were just connecting and what the two of you were just saying, I think, Nicole, to get to the kind of place you're talking about requires a kind of revolution. But one of these modernist concepts that we also need to challenge, and this emerged really clearly in a conference I was part of organizing a couple years ago with our colleagues, Jackie Smith and Patrick Manning and John Markoff, even that modernist concept of revolution is problematic in this context, right? It's about seizing control of the state as the apparatus that's necessary to direct things like the economy and policing and policy and all these things. And while that isn't unimportant, it's not the kind of deeper transformation that we're going to need to get to the kind of place that you were just describing. Which brings me to, I'm conscious of the time, and brings me to the last thing I wanted to bring up with you both, because it's partly selfish, but it's also really connected. Because I think in thinking about the scale and depth and profundity of these challenges over the last 8 months in this context of tremendous loss that we've been that we've been alluding to, I've just felt really sad lately. And I'm curious about the two of you.
Absolutely. I mean, we were talking earlier in this conversation about how, you know, for me at least, this concept of loss felt like something not connected to me, right? Something far away from me that I could study intellectually. And it doesn't anymore, right? I mean, the fact that we're having this conversation while staring at our computer screens instead of being in solidarity and fellowship and, you know, human corporeal space with each other is really profound. I mean, it's absolutely, you know, not only do we need, right, a new way, I mean, I guess this links to what we were just talking about. I mean, a new way of bringing emotion into our public and collective lives and political lives, right? And a new way of being willing to be vulnerable. And that one of the kinds of, with maybe new ways of thinking about revolution, right, to link it to what we were just talking about, is, you know, new ways of being able, right, is a psychological revolution, a willingness to lean into ways to support one another and to express vulnerability with one another.
Yeah, that's a really, really nice way of putting it. I think I would, sad is a good descriptor, I think, for how I've been feeling, a little, you know, sort of brokenhearted. It's devastating to stop and, or just devastating to look around. I have two children and teenagers, and my son is honestly asking me questions like, what's the point of even working hard in school? What future is there? What does this even matter? You know, if given what he sees, the discourse happening in social media, happening politically, he's wondering about kind of what's the future and where does work and scholarship and knowledge even fit into that future? And what's really worth spending time doing? And I mean, as a mother, you know, it's devastating to see that kind of fear that teenagers are feeling and to feel it myself. And I guess what I try to say is to stay hopeful and say, you know, that, well, the world is ending. This really bad, yucky world that we've been talking about is ending. And we need to get educated to lead forward toward the next world, the new world we're going to build together that is going to be rooted in this solidarity and this deeply, you know, the beautiful aspects of humanity, the things that really make us whole. So yeah, these are heavy times for sure. And it's really nice to have the opportunity to talk about feelings.
My teenager, I mean, the thing that brought my teenager back from a fairly dark place over the summer was first to participate in the Black Lives Matter protests, and then through some of the new relationships and new connections that they made through those protests, to join a socialist party. And it's been really beautiful seeing them come into a political flourishing and a new place emotionally by having that kind of forward orientation and solidarity and sense of future making. And so, you know, that's one of the things that's giving me hope right now.
Yeah, I think solidarity and future making are really great notes to wrap up on. They remind us that there is a real way in which, out of loss, out of this kind of profound sense of disorientation and precarity, I think Nicole was the word you used earlier, out of that can come something positive and transformative. It doesn't need to be debilitating, and it's not merely an aesthetic or intellectual thing in the end after all, but it's about that community with people and solidarity to build something, even if we're constrained in what we are able to make. Making it together makes all the difference.
Yeah. And I'll just, on that last note, my neighbor across the street, who's a labor activist, he always reminds me, he says, hey, the struggle, this is the fun part. This is life. You know, the struggle is life. And like you're both saying, it's through that struggle, through that solidarity with others, that fellowship that we see who we are and we see what we want and we create the future, right? The future is wide open. It's multiple. Well, maybe it's not wide open, but it is certainly not made. And so this, you know, let's hope that this moment we're in is going to be a kind of revolution or beginnings of one, perhaps.